Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, one of the smallest countries in the world has won a climate case in the highest court in the world. And first, the Trump administration has canceled a series of sustainability projects as part of its return to supporting fossil fuels over renewable energy. What are the economic and environmental impacts of this decision? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Energy costs are an essential factor in the economic health of a nation. Energy literally powers an economy. And of course, energy choices have profound impacts on the environmental health of the nation and of the planet. So for years, nations all over the world have sought to diversify their energy options and explore greener ones. It makes both economic and environmental sense. But the Trump administration has waged a political campaign against green energy. From the president's personal dislike of wind power to his charge recently at the United Nations that the pursuit of green energy was a scam, the U.S. has sought to suppress green energy research. In light of this campaign, with the current government shutdown, on the first day, the Energy Department canceled over 300 projects. And by the way, they were all in 16 states that were won in the 2024 election by Kamala Harris. So ending green energy projects and political retribution seem to be the theme. On today's show, we're going to focus on the environmental impact of the cancellation of these projects and the general anti-green campaign by the Trump administration. Our guests are Kelly Sanders. She's an associate professor in the USC Sunny Astani Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. She runs the Sanders Sustainability Systems Group, and in 2024, she served as the Assistant Director of Energy Systems Innovation at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And Shannon Gibson. She's professor of environmental studies at the University of Southern California. She is a regular contributor to the conversation on environmental issues, and also she runs the Gibson Climate Justice Lab at USC. Kelly Sanders, I'll ask you the first question. The Trump administration canceled a number of projects on the first day of the government shutdown. What does this mean generally for the pursuit of green energy options in the United States?
It's an interesting policy move. It's not surprising, but, you know, on day one of the administration, the federal government, the Trump administration passed a series of executive orders that indicated that we were in an energy emergency. And so it's interesting that within the context of an energy emergency, we're canceling some of these projects. And, you know, if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, we would have these tensions between cost and, you know, climate change action or reducing pollution and that kind of thing. But now we're in a regime in which if you are just a cold, hard capitalist, wind and solar are the cheapest forms of energy by far. Cheaper than natural gas, half as cheap as coal. So coal is twice the cost on a levelized cost of energy basis as solar or wind. So if we really care about, one, meeting load growth, so if you care about powering all of these data centers, which is not only important for our economic security, but also our national security and our geopolitical, you know, stance in the world, it doesn't make sense to me that we are canceling some of the most economical projects.
Shannon Gibson, you focus a lot on climate justice questions, and it makes me think of, I mean, the president had promised to cut the cost of living, to cut inflation and make it just more affordable to live in this country. Canceling these green energy projects has to have an impact on power bills, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that his initial campaign promise was to cut, right, energy prices in half within 12 to 16 months. And that's simply not going to happen. I think we've seen oil prices coming down, but that's not due to any part of the current administration. That has more to do with OPEC, right? Our petroleum producing countries ramping up production. So in terms of bringing down prices, that's most likely going to be an unfulfilled promise by far. And beyond that, it's interesting. Politico just came out with a report, right, that says that if you look at the administration's own data, right? The data that they currently have, that in fact, as Kelly was mentioning, that wind and solar are cheaper, right? And even the claims that they're less reliable aren't true either. So I think in terms of the cost aspects, again, these are unfounded claims. And then from a justice perspective, right, the idea of doubling down on oil and coal extraction, we know that these are they have been devastating to communities, right? They're harmful for a number of health reasons, what they do to water quality, to in terms of air pollution and environmental health. And then just to even think about the idea that we do need a just transition. The one of the biggest cornerstones of the environmental justice movement right now is that no one left behind in this transition. And that's to say that we need to do a good deal to retrain and to shift individuals who are in the fossil fuel industry into new jobs. And what this is doing is cutting jobs, right? Tens of thousands of jobs that are at stake here with these various energy projects. And as you rightly point out, predominantly in blue states, but we also can't ignore this is hitting Republican states as well, right? That there's a number of projects that are being canceled in Texas and elsewhere. So there's a lot of sort of ill-defined logic in these moves.
Kelly, I know in the past, you mentioned like 10 years ago. 10 years ago, the question about solar power and wind power, there were huge concerns, isn't probably the right word, research on advancing storage. Where are we now at the ability to store solar and wind power? Because the critique is always if the sun's not shining, you don't get solar power, but storage is the key. Where are we in that research?
Yeah, the regime for storage has really changed in the United States. So it's getting much more economical. And if you look at the installed capacity, so the amount of basically generation and storage that we've added in the last couple of years, the story has been solar and storage. And so, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 did put some incentives for clean energy, including storage, but a lot of that growth in storage has actually been because Texas, a Republican state, has been pushing really, really hard in clean energy. So storage is becoming much, much more economical. And so states like California, like Texas, are actually pushing their state policy to put these resources more on the grid to support some of these renewable development. And, I think that kind of underscores this point that Shannon made. I think the first, headlines about these energy cuts after the shutdown were, the administration wants to punish blue states. But there's actually reporting in the LA Times this morning that some leaked documents say that the next round of huge amounts of cuts will affect red states. And that's, again, I think we have a false narrative in our head just that reflects the historical context. One, we think renewables are expensive. Renewables are actually the cheapest. And two, I think that we think that Democratic states love the renewables. But if you look at the top solar states, so top states for solar generation, one is California, fine. Two is Texas, three is Florida, four is Arizona, and five is North Carolina. If we look at wind, one is Texas, two is Iowa, three is Oklahoma, four is Kansas, five is Illinois. So there's no partisan way to kind of, dice this up at this point. Hurting clean energy or cutting clean energy is going to hurt communities across the board. Both from a financial perspective, not only from the cost of energy, but also a jobs perspective, and of course, then the environmental perspective.
Yeah, and Kelly, I just want to follow up quickly. Texas has become much more dedicated to solar and to wind. Is that directly in response to the energy crisis they had, the winter storm, and we learned that Texas has had these energy issues. What year was it? Was that 21 or 22 when that happened? And is that a direct response to that?
Yeah, so no. So I did my PhD in Texas, so I know its energy system quite well. And the dirty little secret about Texas is it's loved renewable energy for a long time. So it has been a leader for a very, very long time. And a lot of that is because Texas has a lot of private land. So if you look at a map of Texas, there's no public land. And so the ranchers and the agricultural producers, the farmers have realized that if they put solar panels or if they put wind turbines on their private land, they can rack in a paycheck. So that's one of the kind of cool things about Texas is they've started to implement, or they've been doing this renewables thing for a long time, again, because of cold hard capital. Listen, they don't care that it's good for the environment. It's just they're making a lot of money. The other thing that Texas is seeing as an opportunity after the 2021 kind of grid meltdown is that energy storage linked with these renewables can really offer a lot of resilience. And that's also one of the reasons why you see upticks in states like Florida, again, the number three producer of solar energy. People are realizing that in the midst of a hurricane, if they have solar panels, in a lot of cases, that can add grid resilience in the days to come. So a lot of communities are not only seeing renewables as an opportunity from a cost perspective, but they're also seeing it as a resilience perspective, which I think is an important point you made.
Shannon, on that point too, it seems like we have policy coming out of the federal government, possibly policy that's supporting it coming from, some red states. But how much is there a tension between communities and their choices and, their desires for more green energy options? How much can we argue that we're actually pitting this as communities against Washington for some, I don't know, ideological reason coming out of the White House?
I think certainly communities are asking, right, for renewables for the reasons that Kelly just mentioned, right? That it gives communities more stability and more resilience in times of disaster, which we know many of these disasters are being exacerbated by our failures to mitigate climate change thus far, right? And so it is kind of this like unfortunate age-old tale of pitting labor against labor in some cases, because as we've seen, capital has a lot of mobility, right? We can move money around from state to state, country to country, move projects around. I was just hearing that, not only is it renewable energy, by the way, that's being defunded, it's also direct air capture, right? Some of these carbon capture and storage projects. And so companies now are saying, okay, we can't do this in the US, we're going to move it to Canada. Right. And so what's unfortunate is that labor, right, workers, communities, they don't have the mobility. Right. And so that's why it's really having these devastating impacts on the ground. And so it is unfortunate in that respect. And then even to the retaliatory aspect of some of this also, as Kelly was saying, it's hard to look at this and say that there's a direct blue-red correlation about what's happening, because that LA Times story did come out and say that I think that there's an expected another 15, right, million or billion in cuts that are to come. But what's interesting with the direct air capture story is that the ones that were cut, not all of them were cut. The ones that are being kept are the ones that are being backed by Chevron and Shell. There still is a political and ideological story here at play that I think that you're alluding to.
Kelly, were most of these projects, solar and wind, and is sort of ramping up solar and wind the direction that you've advised the White House that you would advise on green energy? Are there other technologies, out there either that we could ramp up or even possibly new technologies that we should be focused on to try to meet some of our energy needs?
Yeah, so the reality of the situation is to run a grid, you need a diversity of sources. So you don't want to run it on all solar. You don't want to run it on all wind. So you need some firm capacity as well. And that means firm capacity is basically I have the ability as a grid operator to dial the generation unit up or generate or dial it down, which you can't do with wind or solar alone unless you have storage backup. And so right now, natural gas is kind of the obvious amendment. But natural gas, it fluctu the prices of natural gas fluctuate according to, geopolitical happenings and that kind of thing, and things that are happening domestically. things that are happening with the weather. And so we have to think about, what will the future portfolio of resources look like? And so people right now are really excited about advancements in nuclear. So there's a lot of talk about small modular reactors, especially as led by the tech companies that are interested in developing those resources for their facilities. There's a lot of excitement about enhanced geothermal, which is kind of like not your grandma's geothermal. Which is much more efficient and has a lot more power generation capacity around the United States and around the world, which is exciting. But it's important to realize that those technologies, like we need to start now. We need to start supporting the development and the commercialization of those technologies, but they're not going to be ready tomorrow. And these data centers are coming online tomorrow. The data centers wanted to come online yesterday. And so we really have to think about what is the portfolio of resources that we need now. And I think, if we kind of take like even the climate argument out of this and go to an all of the above strategy, it might include some natural gas. But even building natural gas right now is really difficult. We actually don't have the turbines. So even if you wanted to build a new natural gas facility tomorrow, we don't have the equipment to do it. They're starting to open up a little bit of capacity manufacturing or manufacturing capacity. But, we kind of have to get started on tomorrow's energy sources, but we really have to let what's working now proliferate, which is wind, solar, and storage.
Shannon, I've had a little bit of a method to my madness here by focusing on the economics to make the case that even if you don't care about climate change, there's an economic case. But I think it's fair to say probably the three of us do care about climate change. What has been this impact of the US's campaign against green energy on the global climate challenge? President Trump went to the UN and told the UN leaders that this is a great scam. And my understanding was those leaders looked at him incredulously. Yeah.
Yes,
Go ahead.
absolutely. Me and my research lab were following all of the high-level segment statements at New York Climate Summit, and after his speech, where he did call, climate change this great scam, saying that wind was the most expensive energy ever conceived, that all green is all bankrupt. He was then followed up by 100 plus leaders saying the exact opposite. So he was the outlier in that space. And what we've seen in the course of that week of New York Climate Summit was over 100 countries either formally submitting, I think now we're up to 62 countries who have submitted their official climate pledges to the United Nations in advance of COP30, but over 100, including the EU and China, making headlines by announcing their updated and much more ambitious, mitigation as well as adaptation and finance pledges. So I think that, while his rhetoric, gets a lot of attention and a lot of press here in the United States, it is an anomaly in the global context because very much all the majority of governments in the world are still a part of the Paris Agreement and working in good faith to fulfill the promises, of stopping global warming at 2 degrees and hopefully at 1.5 degrees. So that, as you were saying, right, like climate change, it's very important. It is happening. And when you look at those speeches that were coming out of New York, you have speakers from the Marshall Islands, the Maldives, low-lying island states, other ecologically vulnerable countries who were saying over and over again and testifying very loudly that they are living the consequences now, right? And so it was such a stark contrast to hear his perspective. That was then rebutted over and over again by leaders from around the world.
And Kelly, we just have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to ask the last question of you. It seems like since you're talking about the need for future research, future technology, and we need to start it now, that not only could this have an impact here in the United States, but the U.S. is ceding a whole lot of technological leadership to other countries. And at a time when the U.S. is so concerned about its competitiveness, trade, et cetera, it seems like this strategy of not researching it, the U.S. is just allowing other countries. At the top of the list is, China and their research in solar and, in particular. How concerned are you that as bad as this could be now, 10 years from now, the US is really going to be lagging behind a lot of other countries.
Yeah, I'm really worried about that. The car is here and we're investing in the horse. You know, China is off to the races. They've been leading the renewable energy charge for a long time. They've got the production capacity, they're mining strategic minerals, they have the manufacturing assemblies. They are by far leading this race when it comes to not only, you know, renewable energy generation, but also battery storage and then electric vehicles. There's still room for US leadership. You know, we could decide that we want to be the leader in small modular reactors or enhanced geothermal. But to be clear, we are not making the adequate investments and movements to be in this future economy. You know, other countries are starting to line up and they're off to the races. And I do worry that we're really losing our geopolitical edge here by not taking those opportunities.
Suffice to say, we've got at least three huge arguments why this was a bad idea. It will cost money, it will damage the planet, and will leave the US behind in research that other countries are engaging in. We could probably come up with a longer list, but unfortunately, we're out of time, and I think those three are pretty good. Our guests today have been Kelly Sanders. She is associate professor in the USC Sunny Astani Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. She runs the Sanders Sustainability Systems Group. And in 2024, she served as the Assistant Director of Energy Systems Innovation at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And Shannon Gibson, she's Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Southern California. She is a regular contributor to the Conversation on Environmental Issues, and she runs the Gibson Climate Justice Lab at USC. Thank you both very much for sharing your time, sharing your expertise. Thank you.
When we come back, a small group of law students on a small South Pacific island persuaded their government to take a climate case to the International Court of Justice, and they won. We'll hear about that case, how it developed, and what it means when we return. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In 2019, a group of law students at the University of the South Pacific in the island nation of Vanuatu decided to take the world's governments to court over climate change. They persuaded their ministers to take the case to the United Nations International Court of Justice. Earlier this year, the court issued its opinion that countries are legally obligated to protect and prevent harm to the environment and must take action to reduce climate change greenhouse gas emissions. With us are two experts, both worked on the case, Joanna Guzman and Dr. Justin Sobian. Joanna Guzman is a senior attorney at the Center for International Environmental Law, and Justin Sobian is on the faculty of the University of Auckland School of Law. So welcome to you both. It's so great to have you here to talk about this really momentous decision that happened that you've both been involved with, and so big congratulations. I thought perhaps we should start with, how did this case begin? Justin, would you like to start?
The case, well, the advisory opinion, if you want to put it correctly, it started off in a classroom with there were some 27 students from the University of South Pacific in Vanuatu. Law students who were discussing in a law class, normal day or normal run-of-the-mill day for them, about, and it was an international law class, how can we take climate change to litigation to the courts. I think they were looking at various fora, and it somehow started at the, well, they decided it would start at the International Court of Justice. Now, I learned this from a gentleman called a young lawyer. I'm from the Solomon Islands called Solomon Yao. No coincidence, but just Solomon Yao was his name, and he's originally from Solomon Islands, and he was one of the original students in that class. And he explained that. So that was new to me even after the case, when he spoke about how they were looking at different fora. I think he said they were looking at ITLOS and they were looking for a government, because a state has to support them if they wanted to go to the International Court of Justice, because states have legal standing and not individuals. So an individual like you, me, Joanna, we can't just appear before the International Court of Justice. So he said initially the discussion was to get a state such as Australia or New Zealand, a bigger state in the Pacific, who may have more weight. And two countries said, well, you know, let's think about it. And then one student, after about a week later, said, well, you know, I happen to know the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Vanuatu, and we're in Vanuatu, why don't we ask him? And that's how the history just started from there. I don't know if Joanna probably
would
like
Joanna
to add
Guzman,
something.
What would you like to add?
I just love this story that it really did start with students in the Pacific, those who are on the front lines wanting to take this case. My favorite description of it that they've come up with is taking the world's biggest problem to the world's highest court. There were a lot of naysayers in the beginning saying, you know, this wasn't possible and all of these things. They were very, very strategic about it, not only bringing on Vanuatu, but then having a coalition of states, bringing it first and foremost to the Pacific Islands Forum, which is the body for the Pacific, for all of the Pacific leaders to take on this fight, and then to then bring it strategically to the General Assembly to ask the International Court of Justice these two very important questions. And so I think a lot of us are celebrating how incredible the outcome was, the advisory opinion, bedrock for international legal, environmental, and human rights law. And so we really do owe so much to those students from that classroom in Vanuatu.
So the students first went to their own government, their own ministers, and persuaded the state of Vanuatu to be a participant that would then take it. And then it went from there to the coalition, and from there to the assembly. Is that correct? And so how many states ended up being part of the participatory body?
Well, they had a core group of states, really, at the beginning. So, of course, it's initiated in Vanuatu. And then Vanuatu were looking for partners, what they call core members of the resolution. If I recall, it would have been like maybe, it wasn't more than 10 states, if I recall. I mean, I remember Antigua and Barbuda were one.
Yes, there is a group of the 18 friendly states, so they say. And it was really historic, the General Assembly request to begin with, because it was over 132, just over that, who supported this request for an advisory opinion for the resolution, which passed, you know, without any naysayers. Yeah, exactly. Which is in and of itself a historic feat.
So the states that might not have wanted it, like the United States, for example, under the current administration, they didn't naysay it.
Well, I have an opinion on that. I think they needed 97, the majority of states, and there are, I think, 193 states of the UN, and they needed 97 states fit to pass. They just needed a simple majority. But they end up recognizing 132 states, as Joanna said, all about that, actually supporting it. So I think when it went to the General Assembly, they already had in their minds a majority, and I think states knew that. And I think if any state had tried to call it in a vote, they would have probably realized that they would have lost. And I don't think at that point in time, politically, any state would want to put themselves on a limb to say, well, we don't want to decide this, when the majority were there. And it wasn't just a simple majority. It seemed like at least almost a two-third majority, if you do the maths, maybe. So I think politically, I think there were some states who didn't want it to go to the ICJ, but politically, they just had to be silent, I think.
So, Joanna, you mentioned there were two questions that were taken to the ICJ. What were those?
Really, the important bits of this were, first and foremost, what are states' obligations to protect the environment, climate systems and parts of the environment, and then what are the consequences for breaches to those obligations, specifically for small island developing states and future generations. So it was a very, very strategically worded, negotiated text that really was historic for ensuring that we clarified international law on this fact and then made sure there was teeth behind it, that there is a discussion on actual consequences when those obligations aren't met.
Well, I want to get right into that because advisory opinions are generally thought of as not having teeth. So where do the teeth come from?
Well, if I may, the teeth come from the fact that, as Joanna said, we are going to the world's highest court. At the world's highest court, there's no chance of an appeal, really. But I think, yes, generally speaking, advisory opinions do not have, are not binding. But the law that it actually is going, the court is actually looking at our binding law. So it would look at the Paris Agreement, it would look at human rights treaties, the UNFCCC, and so they would make pronouncements on how to interpret these binding treaties. So, for instance, the advisory opinion, when it came to Section 2 of the Paris Agreement, which sets the temperature goals, it says that states should try to keep that temperature between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. But the ICJ, in its judgment, in its opinion or ruling, as I prefer to say, they actually said, well, when you look at the IPCC science and what the science says on it, trying to go at 2 degrees is basically signing a death warrant. In fact, even if you're at 1.5 degrees, it's still not good for small island developing states. So they actually, in my mind, my interpretation of their agreement is that you focus on the 1.5 and they kind of threw the 2 degrees out of the window. So I think that when you're interpreting now future COP negotiations or future environmental law negotiations, I think that the ICJ is saying that, you know, we should really focus on 1.5 and not even go near 2 degrees. So I think that's a great example which we can show that it interprets binding treaties and how we could actually apply them in the future.
Joanne, what would you add?
I would just add, you know, no one case is going to be the windfall for the amount of challenges that are mounting for dealing with climate change around the world. But what this advisory opinion does is lay a very clear blueprint for precisely the type of climate litigation that needs to follow. And we give it teeth by civil societies pressuring their governments to actually take on, you know, NDCs, nationally determined contributions, to actually keep it within that 1.5. You give it teeth by taking to the streets and demanding, just like the ICJ said, to phase out fossil fuels and stop the, you know, proliferation of them in the face of the science that is so clear about how our very survival depends on changing our economic and energy systems. You give it teeth by walking into those negotiation rooms and saying, enough, United States, this is what is clear. And that we have, just like Justin said, these are countries that have hold in the balance, you know, sea level rise and all of these issues and challenges. These are things that need to be stopped so that countries have a fighting chance to be able to continue in the way hundreds and thousands of years that the Pacific and other small and developing states have lived in harmony with the environment. One of the things that I love about, you know, the podcasts like these and many of the panels I've seen Justin and sit on and the students sit on is that we need everybody to know about this and we need them to take this up, because as wonderful as the advisory opinion is, it's only the beginning, because we've got still a long way to go to ensure that we're on the right path really before this decade ends.
So I have two directions I want to go. And the first one is that countries like the U.S., we know they're major emitters of, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and one of the worst offenders, but it has pulled out of the Paris Agreement. Does that matter in the case of this opinion?
It does matter to an extent. Well, it does and it does not matter. It does matter to the extent, okay, just for the fact the United States is one of the largest greenhouse gas polluters. And if it pulls out of that agreement and does what it wants, then we are just going around in circles, of course. But it does not matter to the extent, and I think Joanna touched on it rightfully, civil society and other youth groups and so on have, the grassroots movement really started this whole change. I mean, you could go all the way back and say Fridays for the Future and all these, but the grassroots movement will always be there putting pressure on states. And I think to that extent, countries which tried to pull out of the Paris Agreement, US included and whoever else, they would, I think, be a bit marginalized or ostracized from the international community because the states, we don't operate in a vacuum, right? It's not one state ruling. I think we've passed that terms in terms of geopolitics, and we're entering a more multipolar world where a lot of different states, a lot of different, you know, we see the BRICS, we see the EU, we see different formations, CARICOM, Pacific Island students, you know, as maybe the greater protagonist. So I think just one state being out, I think we are enough, I think, to create that pressure, to create that change that Joanna, speaking from the grassroots movement first, and they're the one that actually sparked the fire for the other states to act.
Before I move on, Joanna, is there anything you'd like to add on that?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, specifically in the advisory opinion, it talks about these are customary legal obligations to prevent transboundary harm and to do so cooperatively. So even in the case of the United States, who's pulling out of the Paris Agreement, which doesn't go into effect until a year from doing so legally, but, you know, there are, given the current administration, they're not going to show up at these negotiations. But even in those cases, you have customary legal obligations to be limiting emissions, to be doing what you need to be doing on this. So even without the U.S. technically being a party to the Paris Agreement, they still have international legal obligations, customary international legal obligations to protect the climate system and the environment from transboundary harm and to do so cooperatively. We all know, just like you said, Justin, you know, there's a lot to be said about multilateralism right now and geopolitics, but this is a global problem and we have to do so collectively. And there will be a lot of eyes to these large historical emitters like the United States to right the wrongs that they've put forward.
So you mentioned a little while ago, Joanna, that this really opens the door for other litigation, that, you know, you can hold states to account somehow. Has any of that emerged yet? And if not, are there some that are sort of underway already? I mean, because, you know, the latest science is that we have 3 years before we surpass that 1.5 Celsius threshold that is going to throw the planet into some really uncertain, potentially tipping points, right? So that's 3 years. That's 2028. What is occurring now and what has occurred so far for like an emergency litigation?
Yes, that's a great question. And, you know, I will just say for confidentiality purposes that there are a lot of smart lawyers in this region and beyond that are working specifically on these very niche cases.
And just for listeners, you know, to know that Joanna is currently in the Pacific Islands in the country of Fiji.
Yes, correct. I'm based here in Suva. And so, you know, definitely there are strategic conversations and litigation that's happening. But, you know, even beyond that, we've already seen national case law that has already quoted the International Court of Justice and the types of incredible things that it said. And that's what we need. We need more and more citing and usage of the language within the advisory opinion to kind of ripple through case law so that, again, it gives teeth to the advisory opinion itself and gives actual accountability that we need to see in the law rising to the level of the threat that we see from climate change.
It's a bit too early to call, but it's been a month and maybe 9 days since the decision. But I must say we have groups already organizing, Pacific and the Caribbean, I know for sure. I've been speaking to Joanna's counterpart, colleague, Kate in the Pacific SPC, trying to organize regional meetings. In the Caribbean, we have an online meeting that's supposed to take place later this month. But countries are now actually sitting down thinking, okay, we have this advisory opinion. We have it on paper. But the paper is worthless unless you bring some kind of action behind it, right? I think these kind of decisions you cannot really make overnight. I think they will have to have a clear thought out process of what we want to do, what direction we are heading. But there's a lot of information in there that states, especially small island developing states, can use to their benefit.
So that's one of the things I wanted to just, because people who listen to this who are not from the Southern Hemisphere may not quite understand what is at stake for the island communities. And so many of them may not even be able to place Vanuatu on a map or Fiji on a map. And so maybe we should actually pause for a minute and talk about what's at stake for island communities and which ones are most threatened. Tuvalu, for example, I know is threatened with potentially being erased from sea level rise. So maybe this is something that you guys can each comment on, Justin.
Yeah, well, It's a really good thing that you first mentioned Tuvalu. In the opinion itself, or during the proceedings, I was the first. Well, it first dawned on me based on a submission. Maybe it was Tuvalu, I would assume, or Fiji has to be one of them. But they actually, one of those delegations actually said that we have migrants already living, climate migrants living in Fiji, right? Tuvalu, that is. So Tuvalu is some parts of the, because it's an archipelago, and some parts of their low-lying states, coral reefs, some parts of their country are underwater. That's a reality. And there I draw the distinction between, you know, because working with the Pacific and the Caribbean, I draw the distinction. I think that in the Pacific, they are experiencing climate change to a greater degree, more than we are in the Caribbean. Firstly, the Pacific Ocean is the biggest ocean in the world. The Mariana Trench goes down. It's the most deepest oceans that they have. And they are really big ocean states there in the Pacific. The Caribbean is exactly what it is. We have a Caribbean Sea. A sea is just it's just a smaller part of an ocean. And although, yes, we have been experiencing sea level rise, but I think the threat of sea level rise, it really felt more acutely in the Pacific region because of the vastness of the sea and because of the fact that most of the islands are underwater. But that doesn't mean that the Caribbean is going underwater. We are as well. So what is at stake is sea level rise and the total wiping out of communities, wiping out of villages, wiping out of entire countries. So where do these people live? States have also said under the Montevideo Convention, for example, to be a state, you must have a population, you must have a government, and you must have territory. And that's a good thing I want to touch on afterwards. But what if you don't have a territory anymore?
Or if it's underwater. Yeah. I mean, that's still territory.
Yeah. Your land is still there. It's just underwater. That was another argument made, right? But that was the fear or the apprehension that states has. What happened if we no longer have a territory? Does that mean that we're no longer qualified as a state? Does that mean that now we have to renounce our statehood to the UN community? What does that mean? Or can we operate as a de facto state in another state, like what the Tuvaluans are doing in Fiji? So these are the pressing 21st century issues that the ICJ attempt to deal with. And I guess we can get to that later.
The other one that I think is really threatened with being completely underwater is Kiribati.
Yeah.
And were they involved? With...
Yes.
Yes, they
okay.
were.
Okay.
Yeah. Joanne, yes. I was worked very closely with Kiribati, and I just want to say I thought one of the most brilliant things that the Pacific did in this case was bringing to life what sea level rise is to communities, especially since we were brought to The Hague, far away from places that would even understand what an atoll is. It's really, really difficult until you go and visit Kiribati, Tuvalu, these places. I think SPC did a wonderful job supporting governments that wanted to bring these stories to bear. And so I really encourage listeners to take a look at the written submission. Tuvalu is a great example. We did a collected video testimony of what it means to have sea level rise. We kind of think, so what, the water level is at your ankles and then it rises to your shins. That is so far from the reality of what it actually means impact wise. And these states did such an incredible job of showing like what happens to sea level rise when you have ancestral burial grounds going underwater. What does that mean to non-economic loss and damage? What does that mean to countries and landowners who can no longer farm because you have sea
salt water
destroying plants? It goes so far beyond what anyone can really imagine and really understand when it's somebody's home, somebody's ancestral home, and how connected the Pacific is to it. I always say that in the Pacific, So many of the words for water, for sea, land, and people are exactly the same word. There is no sort of Western thought of separating, land and law of the sea and people. It's really harmonized and is one, and I think it's a sort of quite a beautiful way
It
to
is
look
beautiful.
at and show really what is at stake when it comes to these. So I would say we did a lot to bring into light and to have the video testimony. For example, Carabas did that, where we've interviewed one of the very first villages that was displaced because of sea level rise and what that meant to the folks there. It was like a loss that goes beyond really what words can describe. And so being able to project their stories in front of the judges, I think, was a pretty tactical and strategic and brilliant way to make real of something that maybe 15 judges who are in The Hague wouldn't have as a good of a picture of what it meant.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, I mean, I imagine the storms and the intensity of the storms are also wiping out villages.
Well, that's another question. I was going back to the sea level rise. We did have video testimony as well with graves in Grenada, Carrickmacross Island off the mainland of Grenada, which are totally underwater. And some are actually floating. And we had a witness testimony stating that basically we in the present generation have a duty to take care of not only our ancestors who are living, but our ancestors who are passed away. So they felt a bit of guilt that they cannot take care of their ancestors who are now drowned or in the middle of the ocean. But going back to the storms intensity, yes, in the Pacific we call them cyclones, but in the Caribbean we call them hurricanes, but they're the same word, same destruction, unfortunately. And storms, such hurricanes, such as we have been seeing an intensity of storms in the Caribbean in up to 2025 last year. Hurricane Beryl was the fastest record storm that occurred early in the hurricane season, which runs from June to November. It occurred early June and it ended up being a hurricane two, category two to category five within a matter of days. And it was kind of astonishing because Prime Minister Deacon Mitchell from Grenada, he indicated in a letter to the UK Foreign Secretary just before, well, in the middle of the advisory opinion, or just before, stating that basically these hurricanes, Hurricane 5, when they experienced one in 2004, it actually wiped away 200% of Grenada's GDP. And that basically, a nutmeg tree, for example, which is Grenada, after Indonesia, Grenada is the number two producer, a small, tiny spice isle, as we call it, the Spice Isle of Grenada. They are the number two producer worldwide of nutmeg and nutmeg and spices after Indonesia. And basically, to get a mature nutmeg tree, you need 12 to 15 years. And that nutmeg tree, actually, or trees or plantation, can be wiped away in a matter of 24 hours, right? So then you have to start back planting your nutmegs again. But between 2024 to 2024, 20 years after, another hurricane came. So they are in a vicious cycle of debt, a vicious cycle of losing and export earnings. And the funny thing is, or the ironic thing about it is that when these countries, and I'm not only speaking about Grenada here, I'm speaking about other small island states, when they have to rebuild their economies, who do they go to? They go to the United States. They go to the
World
Europe. They go
Bank,
for, yeah, they go to borrow money.
IMF,
And
and end up in debt.
and it's just a vicious cycle of debt.
Yeah.
When they said, this is incredible. So that's why they were saying, well, we want debt-free loans. In fact, we want a cancellation of all the interest that you have to pay.
Absolutely, yep.
So all of these things, and that brings us now into the reparations issue, right? So all of these things just says that, well, it's a bit of a, it's unfair. You know, we are, every year we have to build back our economies. And we are paying you interest, and we are not the
And
ones.
you're causing it.
Yeah, exactly. We are not the ones responsible. So that is the direct challenge we have with climate change in the Caribbean. That is the hurricanes.
Yeah, and I think it's not that different in terms of the storms in the Pacific as well, and the flooding, as I think there are several islands that also were flooded out and villages that were destroyed. Joanna, do you know about those?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was very meticulously taken, especially in Vanuatu's submission to the court, showing precisely the types of damages and the cycle similar to what Justin was talking about, of how you just can't get out of, you feel like you're just getting over the damage left by one cyclone when the next one hits. And even if it's a lesser cyclone, you're still being hit with lesser infrastructure. So you have greater harms, greater destruction, greater loss and damage, costs more. And it's a cycle that just repeats itself. So, when these things were brought to the court, we were talking holistic pictures of climate justice, holistic pictures of everything from loss and damage and finance to non-economic loss and damage and beyond. And so I think, this is just the beginning of seeing exactly the types of case law that can come of this and exactly the types of accountability that needs to happen.
Last couple of things that I wanted to talk about. One is, I know this ruling does nothing to protect the climate human rights defenders, the environmental human rights defenders, and we know that thousands are being attacked, whether it's online or, red tagging or in some cases actually killing them. Is there anything that we can derive from this to protect defenders?
Well, to be quite honest, the ICJ, if I may come in here, the ICJ, it did speak about the obligations to these type of vulnerable persons without mentioning, of course, human rights defenders. The Inter-American Court on Human Rights were very strong on human rights defenders. So that is one tool in our toolbox that we can use if you want to, say that the ICJ didn't. And it probably was, they probably didn't speak about it because I'm not quite certain how many nations spoke about it, but maybe they felt it wasn't within the scope of the question as well. Even though there's room to argue that they are vulnerable persons, right? But yeah, I think that when we look at the amalgamation of the because this decade I will call I have called it well, self-proclaimed it as the decade of climate litigation. And we had three, or the decade of the advisory opinions. We had three. That was ITLOS, that was the Inter-American Court of the Human Rights, and now the ICJ. And there's now in the Woodworks advisory opinion on the African Court for Human and People Rights, and that will be heard in, well, supposed to be heard in Tanzania, because that's where the seat of the court is. I've been hearing rumors maybe September 2026, so we're about a year off from that. But I do think that, yes, the ICJ could have possibly have done more for the human rights defenders. But when you look at it in the totality, I think the international law jurisprudence has been moving there, especially by the work of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights.
Joanna.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think, though, that the court was very clear about the application of human rights law and climate change, and that it is part of the amalgam of various international obligations that states have in order to protect against climate change. And so the fact that human rights law in general is a bedrock of all of that, and that there are various treaties that have very specific outlines of human rights defenders and what is owed to them being at the front lines of many of these. And selfishly, I will also just plug, I think, we have seen the majority of a lot of these human rights defenders on the lines are indigenous populations. And the court was very specific about indigenous populations having other forms of protections needed, and the heightened, connection between indigenous peoples and the conventional biodiversity and what is at the, one in the same in many cases. And I think we will likely see some things come out of litigation related to this. And I think it would be a hotbed for the types of test cases that need to come out of really showing precisely there is no limits to what human rights is owed in these cases, particularly when we talk about fossil fuels.
So this started in 2019, and it took until 2025 to get this. Why did it take that long?
there was a procedure that I don't think you can just go to the International Court of Justice tomorrow morning. The procedure was broken up into two stages. There was, as I saw it, there was the political stage, trying to get that 97 countries across the line, which took an awful lot long time. If you may recall, Palau tried this 2008, 2009, I believe. So they tried it before. Again, another Pacific state on the front lines, sea level rise and so on, losing statehood. And of course, the United States put a block to that. Well, one of the countries, because of the, you know, special arrangement. So getting across the line politically would always have been a difficulty. So that took at least, because it went to the General Assembly in 2023. So let's say that took like 4 years already. Well, let's say 3 years, mm-hmm. going on to four. But once you got to that stage and the resolution was approved, you have all these backward, forward movements and so on. And then at the beginning, it wasn't easy. They were, even my own region speaking to them, they were just like, first questions were like, okay, who's Vanuatu? Of course, that would always come up. But then, and why is Vanuatu doing this? You know, is this a state? I had comments like that, right? So I must say, persons didn't really take it seriously, I would think, for the first year.
Right? It was so just, really, yeah. Palau kind of paved the way in a sense.
Yeah, Palau did speak about it many years ago before, right? Yeah, yeah. But for some reason, they said it never got to the legal stage, which was when it went to the ICJ. A resolution was never passed. I don't know if one was ever drafted, but states put a block to it. But I think the difference is now that, again, civil society, students, people are just becoming more conscious, more aware of what's going on. The climate is getting worse. Governments are not heeding attention. So I think this ICJ movement was a vote against how states are handling the climate crisis. I think that's a vote against, it was a vote against how states are operating. So I think that was why it, these things take a little while diplomatically.
Thank you both so much, Joanna Guzman and Dr. Justin Sobian. It's been such a pleasure to host you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Maria.
Vinaka.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.